So I will turn the mic over to Jerry so that he can do the talk. And I'm going to make you a host, Jerry.
Thank you, Lauren. Appreciate that
Welcome.
guidance. I kind of feel that surge of being a host now, you know,
Yes.
this identity that I can hang on to. I'm not all often at these Sunday mornings, and to the extent I have been, I've certainly enjoyed it, and I've appreciated these gatherings. Good to be here. This month, Sims is talk, or this year, it's kind of what we're doing this year. It's looking at the Dharma in daily life and all the ways that we can use these teachings of mindfulness and the Four Noble Truths and all the other teachings to navigate our lives in a way that's going to be respectful of ourselves and others and leading to peace. This month, we're going to be talking about, we have been talking, just starting talking about the relating to addiction. And this has followed last month, which was about habits. So there's a similarity between the two. And perhaps it's just a matter of degree. But I think when you go into from habits to addictions, you move into a little bit more harmful territory and scary territory. And so it can be more of a challenge. Can people hear me okay? Okay, all right. So I'm going to start out with a definition. You know, what is addiction? And it's one definition, one way of saying it. It's a deep-seated habit of craving. You know, and that causes harm to ourselves or others. And that craving could be around a behavior, or it could be around a substance. And like I was just mentioning, there's a range of degrees, degrees to which there's the grasping and the addiction, and degrees to which the harm isn't, it causes harm. Often we start these Sunday mornings with a story, and I thought about what stories to use. Didn't come up with one other than Winnie the Pooh came to mind. I thought, oh, Winnie the Pooh. Oh, you know, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. You know, the kind bear who kind of showed people the way and kind of bumbled now and again. And they had a strong craving for honey. And we saw it always as, oh, kind of a pleasant little thing. I guess it's good enough to let it go at that. But sometimes these pleasant little things might be pleasant to everybody else, but who knows how Winnie felt at home at night when there wasn't honey. How he felt, or she, he, they felt when I could do anything about it, a suffering around that wanting. So I'm not going to go down that, you know, tunnel too far, but it's just a thought. So it has to do with degree. It has to do with strength. It has to do with degree of suffering. I worked in a mental health hospital for a while, and there was one guy that was diagnosed with addiction to water. So it's not so much the substance, it has to do with the grasping, the clinging, and the pain that's associated with it, the suffering that gets associated with it. I heard just over this weekend, this past week, I had a meditation retreat, and one of the teachers mentioned something that a Buddhist monk said in regard to addiction. And said, addiction is strong greed, weak wisdom. And initially I said, oh boy, I'm not strong, weak, yeah. Initially there was a certain grasping to identity. But on reflection, I thought it was perfect. It was having to do with a strong wanting mind. It wasn't something to be taken personally. And it had to do with not seeing clearly. So wanting mind, strong wanting mind, weak wisdom. The mindfulness wasn't there to see the suffering, the relationship between the greed and the wanting. And wasn't really able to see that relationship between wanting and suffering. So I want to say something about where I'm coming from today. I'm going to be sharing stories about my own addictions, I guess, my own experience around the strong wanting. And however, I don't think I suffered like some have, like many have, who have had addictions. I've never hit bottom like some. And there are some addictions that actually results in people dying. And I think I know, and probably most of you know, how serious addictions can be. So I don't want to come across as glib or some sort of authority or with some sort of facile solution to addiction. I'm going to be talking from my own experience, and perhaps there'll be some value in what I'm saying here. And again, along the same lines, addictions are often rooted in very serious trauma. There's physical and sexual abuse, emotional abuse, as a child or as an adult. The experiences people have in the military, seeing comrades and friends, killed or doing the killing themselves. There can be huge trauma involved in which kind of morphs or gets supported by addiction. So I'm going to be talking about the value of mindfulness and wisdom of Buddhist teachings in regard to relating to craving and addiction. However, in no way do I want to imply or discount the importance of and value of therapy, of medication, and other supports that can be beneficial to understanding and emerging from harmful mental and physical habits of addictions. And looking back, I've been practicing mindfulness meditation about 35 years ago. I had my first mindfulness retreat. And looking back, I consider there are two important benefits of my mindfulness and meditation practice. Early on, almost at the time that I was going through it, that I had the classes, they're quitting the addictions of smoking and quitting the addiction of depression and the related narratives and behaviors associated with both of those. So I'm going to get into this. I'll talk a little bit about my experience in each of those, talk a little bit about my experience with the meditation practice and how that meditation practice and mindfulness was helpful in relating to those, that craving. Just briefly, I want to say when we talk about craving, there are like three kinds. Usually I talk about three kinds of craving and wanting, tana. And the one type is a craving or wanting of self-identity. I want to look good. I want to be seen this way. And there can be suffering about trying to achieve that appearance. There's the flip side of that, of not wanting to be seen this way, or wanting to hide this identity, or wanting to annihilate that identity, or wanting to run away from it. There's grasping towards that. It leads to suffering. And the third has to do with pleasant experiences, trying to surround ourselves with that which we like and are pleasant and push away that which isn't. That grasping and pushing away leads to suffering. So there's going to be elements of those three things in these little stories I have. I'm going to start with smoking. This goes back to one of my late teens, college days. And my father was a smoker, and it started out as a fun thing, a way to connect with friends. And it was kind of like we did at that age, you know, kind of a rebellious thing to do. And it was interesting. It was actually inspired by Bill Cosby. He had these records out about his buddies who got together and started smoking and how cool it was. And I said, oh, yeah, that sounds cool. And I literally started with that story. And then it really got established when I worked in the mental health hospital. And it was an odd situation, a stressful situation. And I was working as an attendant. And the patients there were, we would gather in this day room. And everybody was smoking in the hospital in the day room. The staff, me, the nurses. The patients had rolling machines to roll their own cigarettes, tobacco provided by the hospital. It was a pretty bizarre environment. But so there's an identity around this. There was a strength. And yeah, it was a wanting. Everybody was wanting. Everybody had, yeah. So anyway, that's where it got established. And the identity continued onward in terms of myself. Yeah, I traveled a lot. I smoked Camel filters. I mean, there's certain cachet about, the Camel on it. Yeah, that was cool. When I went to Nepal, I had Yak cigarettes. Yak cigarettes had a yak on it. And I also had these little slivers of wood that I'd pull out. I could tell a story about that. Oh yeah, when I went to Nepal, I got yak cigarettes. And there's a sharing, a camaraderie, a pleasantness, again, identity. However, over time, it became a habit, an addiction. It was no longer fun. It became harmful. I had these hacking coughs, sore throats, bronchitis. For a good part of my smoking career, I was smoking a pack a day. It was no longer a choice. If I was out of cigarettes, I would scour the house for all the ashtrays, trying to find a smokable butt, dismantling a cigarette and finding enough tobacco to roll. It got pretty dang desperate. So no longer fun. So I went from a cool smoker to this addicted chain smoker who kind of smelled like an ashtray. And I wanted to quit. It was painful. And I tried many times, tried and failed. And this is another identity, wanting, grasping. And the identity is I was a person who couldn't quit. I was also smoking Salem menthol cigarettes by now, just to soften it. So no longer the Camel. So, all right. So that's smoking. Depression. I've had a dang good life. And at the time, I'm going to refer to the times, from college days to the mid 80s. I was living a good life by almost any measure. I had all the food, shelter, clothing, good health, good set of friends, good circle of friends, supportive family, interesting jobs, fun adventures, like getting out in nature. By every measure, it was pleasant. There wasn't a challenge here. However, when these things weren't happening, there was a lull, I didn't know how to content myself with nothing, with just being alone, with not much happening, with no distractions. And I got depressed. I got very depressed, and it was a frequent occurrence. It was a daily occurrence. It would go in streaks, long streaks. And there is a set of thoughts and feelings, behaviors associated with them. There was stories about it. It was repetitive. It was painful and long lasting. And it was a secret. My friends didn't know. And I think this talk is being recorded. If I and my friends listened to this talk, my friends from back then, they'd be surprised. So there is a narrative. You know, it was the feeling of being, not knowing what to do, being unhappy. And there was a storyline. The storyline was, this is the way I am. This is the way I always will be. I had suicidal thoughts. I said, I want to kill myself. It would be a repetitive mantra. Fortunately, I never acted on it. I had an image of me in depression. Again, an identity. I imagined myself like one of these fish without a swim bladder. You know, fish can maintain their level in the water by that air bladder. If they don't have an air bladder, they just sink to the bottom. That's what I saw myself. If I swam, I could rise up. If I was active, I could rise up. If I didn't, I sank. So I was happy sometimes, sure. But my norm seemed to be sinking to the bottom. There was an identity. There was a shame. There was a secret. I wanted to expunge this unpleasant experience of being me. It was one of the three kinds of desires. This wanting, not wanting self. So then had a meditation retreat about this, you know, in the mid-80s. A friend of mine, I said, hey, Jerry, you want to go on this meditation retreat down to Brighton Bush? He had been to this before. Our teacher was Ruth Dennison, a wonderful teacher. And I said, yeah. So it was a week-long retreat. And Brighton Bush was beautiful. Lovely setting. It's had these natural hot springs in the middle of these meadows. Deer would roam by. Excellent food, comfortable accommodations. Perfect. And the task at hand was to sit quietly. And it worked for a while, but boy, was that difficult. You know, I learned about the hindrances, wanting mind, aversion, sleepiness, agitation, and doubt. You know, told to turn towards, to be with, to experience, feel them. It was difficult. I could hardly wait for a sit to be over. Struggled and say, oh, this is aversion. Oh, this is wanting. I'd have a narrative. I can't do this. Everybody else is kind of sitting in quiet. I can't do this. This is my identity. I got to get out of here. However, I made it through, and I learned the relationship between wanting and suffering. I learned how to be with the full range of hindrances. I saw how the mind works in terms of the narratives it creates about I can't, I'm this way, I should, I shouldn't, judging others, judging myself. All this became pretty clear after this retreat. And so I come back. Oh, by the way, there's one thing that was curious on the retreat. Me and my friend, you know, there was a smoke at the back then. There was this place where, you know, the smokers could gather and talk or gather. So like every once in a while, I checked in with my buddy and we could, you know, share a smoke and say, well, how are things going? So anyway, bygone days. So anyway, mindfulness practice has been very helpful in letting go of smoking. I wouldn't say I quit smoking. I didn't force it out of my life. It wasn't this huge aversion to get rid of, but rather with mindfulness, I was able to let go of the craving around smoking. With mindfulness, I started paying attention to all the feelings and impulses involved in a cigarette. I noticed the sensation of wanting and say, oh, craving is just like this, just like I noticed on the retreat. I could feel it in my body, you know, mindful of the body. I could feel the contraction. I can feel the strong, you know, just need this cigarette. I kind of did a psychological trick on myself in terms of quitting. I should add right here that I had tried quitting so many times, I always failed. I did not want to approach letting go of smoking and failing this time. So I said, I had a resolution. I said, this year, I'm going to quit for 30 days. I'm going to be a non-smoker for 30 days out of the year. Whatever those couple of days here, couple of days there. I wanted to set it up so that it would be a success and not one more time that I would fail. I thought it worked quite well. But anyway, I start noticing that impulse is wanting to have a cigarette. And I notice the pattern involved there. It was any time there was a transition, a getting up in the morning before starting the day, finishing a meal, ending one thing, starting another. There is always that little discomfort, this discomfort of transition, this feeling of, you know, how do I move? How do I get comfortable here? Cigarettes got associated with something to do, as something to do when there's discomfort and allows me to do something in uncomfortable times. I was able to see that pattern. And so there's two parts of letting go. There is the part of letting go of the actual wanting the cigarette, but there's also a part of recognizing that bit of a wiggle, that bit of a discomfort that I felt that I wanted to get past with smoking. The mindfulness allowed me to be turned towards that. Oh, it's like this. And I did this. I did it for 20 times a day. I would feel it, it would get stronger, it would pass. And then I'd be going on for a while, again and again and again, 20 times a day. And over time, pretty soon, I was okay with transition. I was okay with not smoking. I didn't quit. I just let go. I was just okay with it. I was okay. I didn't make something of it. So likewise, very similarly, I used related to depression like this, recognizing I would see the arising. Yeah, okay, nothing to do. Again, that little, starting with that little discomfort. I don't know what to do here. Unpleasant. This is unpleasant. Then the narrative, it starts with unpleasant. Didn't have smoke a couple of cigarettes. I had behaviors associated. I'll smoke some cigarettes. I'll go down to the local bar, shoot pool, drink beer. That didn't help. I don't know what else, the other things like that. I had these behaviors that, you know, tried to get me comfortable in these times where nothing much was happening. What I would do, I would fill those spaces. This is unpleasant. There was an identity that grew around this. And I say, like I say, this is who I am. This is the way I'm always going to be. I don't want this. I want to annihilate myself. with mindfulness meditation, I could be with that discomfort. I can say, ah, okay, it's like this now. I can relax and feel it. I could see the narrative and how the narrative fed it. The narrative of, the fish without the air bladder, the narrative of this is how it's always going to be, the narrative of, this is who I am. All that, I say, oh, this is just a storyline. Not helpful. Mindfulness recognized that. Mindfulness recognized the essence of the suffering around depression. It recognized just this now. Again, my conditions in my life were okay. Yeah, I had everything I needed, food, shelter, clothing, medical, friends, all that was in place. It was just my mental activity, a habitual response to a discomfort. Mindfulness allowed me to be with that, to relax around that, to let go. Did not trust the narrative. Not trust the narrative. This is not true. This is not to be believed. And then, rather than the narrative beating a certain situation, a certain presence, I turn towards, there's a story, you probably heard the story about which wolf do you feed? That's usually a tribute to a Cherokee Indian story where a grandmother tells her grandson that there's two wolves on each of your shoulders, on your shoulders. One is the wolf of greed, hatred, and confusion, the angry, selfish one. The other one is the one of the Brahma Viharas, by Buddhist talk, the one, the gentle, the caring, the kind one. The practice has a lot to do with which wolf do we feed. Mindfulness recognizes which wolf is asking for the food and recognizes which one do I offer food to. So during depression, I could feed the narrative. I could feed the storyline. Or I could just say, this is the way it is now. And I consider, how can the other wolf get fed? A kind wolf, a caring one. And part of that was self-compassion. Having compassion for myself. Oh, it's like this now. It hurts. It hurts. Part of it would be the wisdom around seeing the difference between, hanging out in my bedroom, going off in these thoughts isn't helpful. Maybe taking a walk might be more helpful. Maybe surrounding, maybe somehow doing something with a little bit more ease might be more helpful. So related to depression, mindfulness, very similar to the wanting around cigarettes. Being with, allowing, allowing to pass. Not identifying. This is not about me. So, recognizing causes and conditions. What feeds into, what feeds this wolf or lab? So both smoking and depression, both had an identity, a narrative. A false but believed narrative that led to suffering. Both had repetitive patterns of wanting or lack of control. Difficult physically, emotion, feelings. That could be recognized by mindfulness. There's both that a grasping, a clinging, wanting component. There's both had some sort of behaviors that supported the narrative. And recognizing these behaviors, they could be let go of. There's triggering conditions. That little gap, those little changes were a triggering condition for both. This discomfort. I feel these discomforts these days. I feel that these days. And I could down a bag of potato chips if I had them in the house around that little discomfort. I don't become addicted to it. I make the decision. I know I'm going to do that. I'm likely to do that. So I don't buy the potato chips to begin with. And I just, when I'm home, I just, okay. Oh, this is one of those transitions where there's this discomfort that arising. So I can see it arise. I can see it pass. So this whole thing, which I see addiction, which I see as the habits I've described, it's basically the Four Noble Truths. You know, there's suffering. Second Noble Truth, craving results in suffering. Third Noble Truth, letting go of craving releases the suffering. It's helpful. I find it very helpful to not only see the craving and the second noble truth, the suffering arising, but at least as important to feed the other wolf, to recognize when there's not craving, to recognize a lack of suffering without craving, to support that rather than dismiss it. Very important. Yeah, get supported by just knowing all's well here, acknowledging, ending the day with gratefulness, thinking back, not only, oh my God, it's over, but thinking back. Yeah, there were some really nice, pleasant things happened. There was times I wasn't craving. I can appreciate that. Appreciation. So I didn't quit smoking. I didn't quit depression, but rather I turned towards the difficult. I allow it to pass. I think I'll just leave it at that. It's just suffering arises. It kind of comes with the territory. This practice that the Buddha shared with us is helpful. It certainly has been helpful for me. Suffering and the suffering. And, which wolf do we feed? So there's a natural letting go, recognizing the positive, encouraging behaviors that are supportive of your best intentions, and not dismissing the joys in our life as just exceptions. So I'll let it go with that. Hopefully some of the things I just shared might be helpful. If not, that's okay too. So thanks for your attention. So maybe just feeling that for a second. When I give a talk, there's a certain energy that I can feel. And I suppose we all see this is one of those little transitions going from this to that. And what we're transitioning to at this time in the Sunday mornings, we break into small groups if you're interested. And have a little, for about 15 minutes in which we can, just talk amongst ourselves and say, okay, let's look at this. Let's look at what Wilbur has just said. So if you're not interested in participating, You could certainly leave, or you could, how else did you do it? Did you leave and come back? You could probably do that. Leave and come back after I dismiss if you want to come back for the Q&A afterwards. But if anybody does not want to participate in the small group discussion, you could take your leave. It was certainly good to see you. I'd certainly like to encourage you to stay, but we all have our ways that we need to do things. So what I'll do is I'll break into small groups. I know some of you are pairs. I'm going to go to groups of three and see where that goes. So some of you may end up in fours because of you have prepared. So any questions before I do that? Just in terms of what to discuss, consider craving. Consider identities around craving. Consider craving for pleasant things, perhaps as a anecdote to unpleasant, or consider how you want to look. Consider how you want to hide an identity. But just consider craving an identity in a way that might ring true for you. So let me see if I can navigate with this breakout groups. Any questions? I don't see anything, so here we go. Sign automatically, create. I have to figure out how many breakout groups to have. Okay, then I got to figure out how many people there are. Three, I'm going to have six breakout groups. We'll see what happens. And good luck. I don't do this often, so if you end up somewhere in Siberia, just come back. Okay, that looks pretty good. Here we go. So I think we're all back. Don't have a lot of time here. I guess we have maybe a question or two or a comment or two. Anybody have anything they want to share or ask?
I would just like to share, Jerry, that your talk was amazing. Thank you very much for it. It's really amazing. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl.
I would just say that as a recovering alcoholic and who also quit cigarettes, your talk blew me away. Absolutely. We had a really lively discussion in our group as a result. And I really appreciate that the way you see things. Thanks.
Thank you. That's touching. That's encouraging. Don't know how I'm going to come across, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
I'll just raise my
hand. Yeah, Carol.
So I can't figure out how to raise my hand, so I did. Mentioned, and then sharing with some of the other reactions, is that I think there's a real aversion along with the craving, that it's staying away from something, it's staying away from the fear. And in fact, I think I really related with, I'm just not going to be able to handle this. And particularly if it's a public situation, that doing something to avoid the situation of whatever is going to happen when I actually deal with it. So this aversion and the fear of it, the fear of what would happen. And I think actually probably the shame of reacting in a certain way that publicly people are going to see your failures.
Yeah.
Is a really big part of it, of actually confronting it, being with it, like you say, being with the discomfort and experiencing it.
Yeah, that's the practice. Recognizing that, being with it, not taking it to heart, not saying this is me, not taking it personally. This is what's going on. Yeah. And it's all right. Yeah. Just seeing all that stuff is gets to be liberating. Thank you.
Jerry, I just wanted to thank you for your emphasis on transitions and how they trigger behavior. And I really got a lot out of that.
Okay. Good to hear that, Ron. Yeah, I still do that. You know, it's my practice these days. I notice that. Yeah. And the difference now, you know, I talked about, you know, some of those addictions, you know, years ago. These days, you know, with mindfulness, they can be recognized. And rather than creating some sort of narrative about it, about me, I'm not good enough, I can't do this, rather than trying to run or get away from, oh, okay, like this now. And be felt. And be felt. And it passes. Not in an aversive way, not in a trying to get rid of way, but on its own accord. May rise again, but so it goes. Yeah. Jean, are you raising your hand?
Yes. It just occurred to me that saying that this is how things are right now is in itself a compassion practice.
Yes.
You know, it's because we give ourselves such a hard time. It shouldn't be like this.
Yeah.
And something's wrong with me. But to just say, this is how things are right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also want to say it was, your talk was wonderful, really helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, I felt it was wonderful too. And I appreciated a lot what you talked about, how this feeling of discomfort triggers so many of these behaviors. But I really like what you said about depression too, and the way that mindfulness sort of breaks that narrative. Because I found that also to be really true for me, that it really broke that narrative of there's something wrong with me that would trigger episodes of depression. And to hear you talking about that was very affirming. So I really think it was a great talk, Jerry.
Yeah, thank you, Linda. Okay, I'll let it go at that. Yeah, it was a pleasure being here, honor to be in this group. So I'm gonna turn it over to Lauren, and she can kind of close our gathering.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jerry, for your offering today. And I want to remind people that talks are recorded. So if you want to hear it again, it will be on the website. And I also want to mention that SIMS depends upon your generosity to operate, and our co-guiding teachers also really appreciate your generosity for their livelihood, and all the teachers appreciate your generosity to help them study and do retreats. And you can donate on the website, and I know a lot of you are doing that. These are difficult times. No one's ever turned away for inability to pay, but we do appreciate anything you can offer. There's a few announcements of things that are coming up soon. Here we go. And that is that on the 21st of April, there's a Buddhist Essentials class. Lindell and Steve
Wilhelm.
Yeah, they're leading it. It's on Wednesday night, and it's on the Four Noble Truths. It's Wednesday, not this Wednesday. It's Wednesday the 24th. And then Suze and Steve Wilhelm are teaching a day long on freedom in impermanence and not self. And that will be, on the 24th. So that's an opportunity to spend the whole day and do some meditating, some discussions, some walking, hear some Dharma talks. It's really a nice way to spend the day. Next month, we have a day of mindfulness on May 15th and a retreat with Narayan Levinson, who's been a longtime teacher. She's the head of the Cambridge, Massachusetts Insight Meditation Center. And her topic is the Four Noble Truths. So a lot of the Four Noble Truths. We also have regular drop-in sits every day of the week, usually in the morning, but there's one in the afternoon on Tuesdays, and those are listed on our website. And then we have our regular Monday evening and Thursday evening sits. And there's an under 40, if you know any younger people, which is the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. So those are some offerings we invite you to take advantage of. And now we'll just take a moment. Yes, we're at the end. So we want to offer the merit of our practice today to everyone. So if we just take a moment to be still again and feel in our heart and body and mind the wisdom that we have received and shared today, and feel how it does offer so much to us, peace and hope and understanding and faith, and may that also be shared with beings around us who we may come in contact with, and all beings known and unknown to us. May we be kind to ourselves and to everyone and learn wisdom. Thank you, everyone.